MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. WILL programs are made possible by the Champaign-Urbana Symphony Orchestra, presenting To Stir the World on Friday, February 19th at 7:30 p.m. at Krannert Center. The program features Vienna-born Gernot Winneshofer on Mendelssohn's Violin Concerto in E minor, Opus 64. More information is available at 351-9139.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Radio and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Today we're going to talk about some remarkable women holding the same job for decades in places with names like the Iron Skillet Truck Stop, Pie and Burger, and the Tasty Diner. We're going to talk about waitresses who call themselves lifers with a former waitress. Her name is Candace Taylor. She is today a multimedia artist and the author of Counterculture, the American Coffee Shop Waitress. We'll also talk about the sense of community you'll find in these establishments this afternoon with our guest. That community is made possible by the women who work there. They're the force that draws the customers, the regulars, back. Candace Taylor traveled across country, logging 26,000 miles to document the working lives of career waitresses. She found them to be proud, hardworking, and very good at what they do. Candace Taylor earned her MA in Visual and Critical Studies from the California College of the Arts. She's an award-winning photographer, writer, and visual artist who produces multimedia, ethnography, and oral history projects. And you'll find her online at www.taylormadeculture.com. Her name is spelled T-A-Y-L-O-R. Candace Taylor's book, Counterculture, is published by the Cornell University Press. Candace Taylor, welcome. Thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you. It's such an honor.
One of the places you went to was a 150-year-old lunch counter in Kentucky. Was that George J's?
That was George J's in Glasgow.
Yeah. What's the place like?
What's it like?
Yeah.
Oh, it just looks like it's been preserved in time. It's just beautiful. The counter is still there. A lot of the signage from the old pharmacy is still there. And May, who was a waitress who I interviewed there, my gosh, she was in her 80s when we did the interview. And her regulars have been with her since the 50s. It was incredible.
Yeah. She's now retired. But
she
worked at George J's for 50 years.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit more about her.
May grew up in Kentucky. She hadn't lived in Glasgow her whole life, but she was really focused on, you know, farm work. She was mostly, a lot of these women in the book were farmers or had grown up doing farm labor. So when they started waitressing, they found that, to them, the physical labor wasn't too taxing. One waitress said, you know, compared to picking cotton, waitressing's pretty easy. So that was kind of May's story as well. She had done several years of farm living, and when she started waitressing, she just took to her customers. It's a locals' place. A lot of her customers, like I said, have been coming and sitting with her for almost 50 years. So one of her regulars, Senator Baker, was there while we were doing our interview, and he's also featured in the book as well. And he just made wonderful statements about May, just saying, you know, it's just not the same without her. And the reason why we come here is, you know, because of May.
Yeah. Now, this establishment goes back 150 years. Can you give us a thumbnail history of the diner?
You know, I don't really know that much about the diner per se. I know that where it's located, it just looks right out of an Andy Griffith television set. It's literally on a square, and everything is very right out of mid-century America, Americana, just very quaint. People seem to be, you know, very quiet. If you want to find out the local gossip, you go to George J's and sit at the counter and listen, and you'll know pretty much everything that's going on in town. So it's definitely that small town atmosphere. But it also started out as, like I said, a pharmacy, one of those soda jerk fountain pharmacies, and now it's more just a diner. I don't think they still have the Hamilton Beach mixers, you know, that you see from the 50s.
Well, when in our history in this country did diners, coffee shops, cafes begin to crop up, and who did they serve? Did they begin as pharmacies or attached to pharmacies?
Actually, diners, the classic definition of a diner, which was born on the East Coast, and that was in the 1870s in Rhode Island. And they generally were places that had been created in some kind of factory and built in one piece and moved to a location for business. But the idea of a diner was that it could move from place to place, because a diner was generally strategically located across the street from some kind of business or a factory. It was largely frequented by men, and they would definitely be there right when people got off of work or when they were on break. So that's when they got their business. And like I said, they were largely mostly male establishments.
So when and how did women become customers?
Women were kind of lured into the diner scene around the 20s. It's funny, diner operators basically figured out that there was a whole demographic that they were forgetting about, and that they could increase their business during business hours when all the guys were at work. They could have women customers. So they started putting different props outside, like flower pots or baby carriages or things to tell women that this was a female-friendly place. Segregation was a very real issue. The Yankee Diner, I believe in Massachusetts, used to seat women only in the basement. And for a lot of women, you know, would walk past these places, it was kind of a bar saloon type atmosphere. You know, there were a bunch of grungy guys and using foul language, and women thought, you know, this isn't really a place for me. And there were no booths, there were just stools. A row of stools, so it wasn't very ladylike to sit on the stool, and especially if you were wearing a dress. So the diner started putting booths in to encourage, you know, families, women and their children, and the men didn't like it. You know, they thought that they were losing their space that was comfortable, you know, for them to misbehave or just do whatever they wanted to do. So there was a lot of controversy, and you can read this in part of it in Counterculture in the book, but in 1941 there was a publication called The Diner that discusses a lot of the issues that came from introducing women.
When did women begin to work in these places?
Soon after that, definitely around the 40s, you saw a lot more women working in so many different places. They weren't naturally working because of the war. But, you know, in the early 40s, and that's not to say there aren't exceptions to that. I'm sure there were women working in diners before that. But that's when it was more common that they would be there. And there's a list in the Diner magazine, there was a list of reasons why women should work in diners. And, you know, it's hilarious. They say basically, well, we can just pay them half the amount of money. And they work twice as hard as men, and they're not late, and they don't call in sick being hungover, and they're nicer, and they're cleaner, and, you know, they had to really build a case for women to be in the diner. So it's kind of ironic because now women are just almost a fixture, as though you think they were always there.
Yeah. What launched you on this odyssey?
Oh, I was waitressing to get through graduate school. I was very exhausted by the work. I worked maybe 4 days a week at the most. And I worked in a sushi restaurant, so I wasn't even in a diner. My shifts were about 4 to 6 hours. The average shift in a diner or a coffee shop for a waitress is about 8 to 10 hours. So I was working pretty much half the amount of time, serving probably half the amount of tables, because diners, usually the waitresses, have larger sections to serve. And I would sit there with my 20-something-year-old coworkers. I was 32 at the time. And we would just commiserate on how tired we were and how bad we felt and how hard it was. And I thought, well, if we're having such a hard time, you know, how do women in their 60s and 70s do this work? And how do they feel about what they do? You know, I was very curious. And I love diners. I read so many books on diners, and I thought that's so strange that there's barely anything about the waitresses, maybe a few pages, if anything. And I thought, my gosh, they humanize the space. Mm. They're the reason why people come. That it was one of the reasons why I would go into diners. And they just had been overlooked. So I was in graduate school at the California College of the Arts, and I decided to make it my thesis.
Who did you seek out, and how did you find them?
Well, I definitely had to go through, I guess, kind of non-traditional channels, because I never really imagined that I would just drive along the road and find who I was looking for. And even if I did find her, it's not likely she would have the time to sit with me and let me photograph her. So I would call the visitors bureaus or chamber of commerce mm-hmm. in different towns that I wanted to visit, and I'd find people who grew up in the area, and I would ask them, you know, what places or institutions, and, you know, what restaurants do you remember from your childhood, and what waitresses do you remember from your childhood who may still be working at these places? And they would suggest one or two restaurants. I'd call the restaurant, speak to the manager, describe the project. He or she might, you know, recommend a waitress or two, and I would do pre-interviews on the phone with her, send out pre-questionnaires, and then plan to take the trip.
Mm-hmm. Did your experience as a waitress help open doors and help you in your interviews?
I think so, tremendously. I think it made a huge difference, only because, you know, we could speak kind of restaurant lingo. In some cases, the waitresses would, you know, say, oh, yeah, everything about it is just wonderful. I love my job. And I'd say, oh, come on. You know, I've been there. You know, there's a hostile customer every so often that just gets under your skin. And I think that really helped, because she knew that I really wanted, that I had been there, that I understood. And I think that's what got me, you know, answers that were just a little more beyond the surface.
Yeah. One of the waitresses, one of the women that you interviewed, her name is Linda Exler.
Mm-hmm.
And she waited tables for 38 years when you talked with her. Mm-hmm. And one of the things she said was, we do have some crazy customers. So how do good waitresses handle the customers who are, quite frankly, jerks?
You know, a lot of them said, you know, I just don't sweat the small stuff. Some make it a game. They think, by the time this person leaves, I'm going to make him or her, you know, smile at me, or just somehow she's going to win them over. A lot of times these waitresses are working in places that have up to 90% regular, you know, clientele. So that's a huge, huge advantage. So even if you have one bad customer, you've got, you know, the rest of them pretty much are your almost your friends. So some of them would say, oh, yeah, if we had a really bad customer, you know, I'd go to my regular Joe and we would just kind of laugh at that person, or just say, you know, how sad, you know, that person's having a really bad day, or, you know, they just really wouldn't take on that kind of energy. One waitress, Sandra, in Napa said, you know, I just tell them, you know, don't pop my bubble. I'm in a good mood today.
And it's funny, I think something else that Linda said was that, you know, once they're there and they get their coffee and pie or whatever, maybe you're putting them in a better mood and things settle down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
At a diner in Yermo, California, here's a sign that the customers find above the door. We reserve the right to refuse service to anyone, regardless of who you are, who you think you are, who your daddy is, or how much money you make. Is that attitude common in counterculture?
It is. It is. And I have to say that's very true. I think class does not, it's like once you enter a diner, class levels out. You know, whether you are a senator or a ditch digger or, you know, some kind of attorney or judge, they all get treated the same by these women. And I think they appreciate it. I think the customers, you know, appreciate it. And I think ideally it's the way it should be. You know, people should just be treated with respect no matter who you are. And hopefully you will act accordingly, that you deserve the respect and you're not rude. But it's a big, you know, it's kind of the last frontier, I think, in terms of when you walk into a diner, you know, you're just a regular person.
And the staff can be themselves.
That's huge. That's very liberating in the service industry. And I think that's why I was so determined to only focus on career waitresses who work in diners and coffee shops because, you know, like I said, I worked in a sushi restaurant, so there was a certain expectation, even though it wasn't like a five-star, you know, fancy restaurant,
mm-hmm.
There's still, the more money people spend, the higher the expectation is about the experience they're going to have. And that falls into the waitress's lap a lot of times. You know, even though the food isn't really her responsibility, the fact that she's bringing it to you and she's kind of on the front lines of anything that goes wrong, you know, she usually gets the brunt of that. You know, when people walk into a diner, they don't really expect a whole lot. You know, they're not really expecting five-star service, although a lot of these waitresses said, you know, I give service as though I work in a fancy restaurant, but I'm in a diner. Whereas other waitresses, you know, said I just could never work in a fancy restaurant because I like to holler at my customers when they walk through the door, you know. I like to be, it's almost like it's their home away from home. So it's very liberating to be able to just be yourself.
Yeah. What was the television show where one of the waitresses said, "Kiss my grits"?
Oh, that was Alice.
Alice.
Yeah, Flo.
Flo. That's great. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Candace Taylor. She is the author of Counterculture, The American Coffee Shop Waitress. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Toll free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Maybe, listeners, you'd like to share a story, a diner story with us, a coffee shop story with us this afternoon. Well, this is hard physical work. How does one do it for 50 years? I mean, some of these women came from, you know, backgrounds where they were doing hard work already as young women. But really, to keep on doing it for so long, is it that because they keep doing it over and over and over again, day in, day out, that it actually keeps them in shape?
That's part of it, for sure. I was shocked that I didn't hear more stories about carpal tunnel syndrome or, you know, arthritis. I did have several waitresses talk about arthritis, but they said that waitressing actually helped them to age well because they're moving constantly. And doctors will tell you the best thing for arthritis is to keep your joints lubricated, to keep your joints warm. Once they get colder and stiffen up is when you have the most pain. So a lot of waitresses said, you know, I'm not even on medication for it anymore. I just keep working. And, you know, they get sore and they get I guess, tired. They didn't admit that they were tired, but they must be tired. But they just keep moving. I think it was Ina Capitan at the Florence Diner in Florence, Massachusetts, said, you know, my doctor says whatever you're doing, just keep doing it. I just couldn't believe a lot of the women in the book are older than they look. And the oldest waitress, who was Ina Capitan, was 83 when I interviewed her. She was a week from being 84. Mm. So, and she had no plans for retirement. I think that, you know, I was so surprised by what I found. I started speaking at aging conferences to show how these women are models of healthy aging.
Yeah. When you set out on this as your master's project, did you have any realization of how much territory you'd cover? I don't mean how many miles you'd cover, but I mean how many areas, how many different topic areas, how many different subjects. I mean, we're talking about American history. We're talking about the history of women. We're talking about labor history, or we will talk about that. In addition to, business history.
Mm-hmm.
Did you begin to think what is my project? What do I focus on?
Well, that's why it's almost taken 10 years of my life, I guess, it's this webbed matrix of, my gosh, there's so many interesting pockets here, and there's so many ways to cross-reference the material.
Speaking to aging conferences,
Right. And now I'm focused more on, you know, women's conferences, and there's other in labor, you know, there's so many different areas this touches. And thank God I got my master's in visual criticism, because that really challenged me to understand and look at all the different directions that this material could grow. It made a huge difference in terms of why I wanted to continue to do the work, because it was so rich for me. And once I started doing research, not just with the interviews, but just, you know, in the library, you know, I thought this story really needs to be told. And when I went to publishers, it was a little complicated, because a lot of people thought, oh, well, it's just a pop culture icon. Let's just do a photo book.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, there's so much more here. There's so much more here. And for every waitress I interviewed for about 2 hours, you know, her interviews were transcribed and logged and indexed for the book. And once I started doing that and seeing how many different concepts were being discovered, I really had to hold out. This book would have been out probably 5 years ago had I not just stuck to my guns and said, no, I want someone who's going to publish their stories, that's going to publish my cultural criticism and the photos. And Cornell has just been great.
Yeah. Well, we opened up the envelope and took out the book, and I said, oh, isn't this fun? And then I began to look at it, and I thought, oh, this is much more than fun.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I wanted to hear. Thank you so much.
Well, back to the topic of waitresses and diners and coffee shops. Did you meet some waitresses who were good at the job and had done it for a long time and didn't like it?
No.
No? Okay.
No. I would have to say that 98% said I absolutely love what I do. I wouldn't do anything else. And I'd say that last 2% were people that said, you know, I didn't think I'd be here forever, but I really enjoy it, and it serves every purpose in my life, and so I'm still here. But not one said I don't like it or don't wish I was doing something else. I think the issue is, waitressing is too hard to do it if you don't want to do it. And if you don't want to do it, you're not going to stay. You'll be a secretary or something else that, you know, if you don't have a college degree that doesn't require a degree, you would fall into one of those jobs. But it's just too demanding. I think that, you know, women who end up waitressing their entire lives have a special affinity or an innate sensibility to serve people, to be, for true customer service. They truly love being around people. They want to help people. A lot of them thought about maybe nursing, which is, I think, very similar to waitressing. You know, they love people.
Yeah. When you set out, though, you expected that these women who had been working all their lives waiting tables would jump at another opportunity had they had another opportunity, and you found that not to be the case.
Yeah, not at all. I couldn't believe it. And that's, I think, the first hook for me. The first 30 or so waitresses I interviewed, I thought it must be a fluke that they've all said, you know, I love what I do. I thought they were not telling me the truth. They're like, there's something, you know, I just have to keep interviewing, you know, these women to find out what's really going on. And it wasn't until probably about 3 years into the project I really started to listen, and I really started to ask different questions, and I really started to understand why they were saying those things to me. But, you know, for the most part, there I would hear things like Linda Exeler, you know, in Erlanger, Kentucky, the Colonial Cottage. You know, she said to me several times, like, God gave me a gift, and this is what it turned out to be, and I'm just so grateful that I have the patience to, and the, you know, love of being a waitress. This is what I was put on earth to do.
Yeah. I wonder if in order to be really good at something, you have to like it. You have to have some passion for it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let's take a call from a listener in Champaign joining us on line one. Good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon. I wonder if the guest has read Barbara Ehrenreich's book, Nickel and Dimed.
Oh, of course. Yes, it was my Bible. I was just speaking about it earlier. I think Barbara Ehrenreich's an amazing labor writer and historian. My experience, though, was apparently different than hers. She basically, you know, went undercover, if you can say that, as a waitress for 30 days in Florida. And her overarching thesis that, yes, you know, people who work minimum wage jobs should be paid better, I agree with 100%. But I think her experience as a waitress, given that she had never waitressed before, really, and that, you know, she's kind of an educated, privileged woman going into a diner, she's, you know, it's not going to be easy for her. And I think that's the main issue with a lot of these women. You know, they didn't start out being great waitresses. They had to pay their dues, and the issue that waitressing is kind of a skillless job is such an unfortunate reality, because it's not. It takes a lot of skill and a lot of time to learn to be good at it. Otherwise, it's grueling, like Barbara Ehrenreich experienced.
I'm sorry if I'm plowing land you've already been over, but I was wondering, Barbara Ehrenreich's thesis generally seemed to be that people who are working, quote, unskilled jobs, unquote, ones that don't require a college degree, for example,
mm-hmm.
Just have no hope of having a satisfactory life in our economy.
Yeah,
it seems you're telling a different story altogether.
You're right. Yeah, I completely disagree. I think after probably about 6 years into this project, I really had to reevaluate what success was. For me, I'm 38 years old now, and, you know, I have a master's degree. I had my master's for many years and kept waitressing because I loved the freedom it gave me. I got pretty much almost a full-time wage working part-time. I could take trips and do this project, and it worked for me. And I had to ask myself, well, why? What's this pressure for me to get a quote-unquote real job about? And, you know, I was making about $30 to $40 an hour waitressing. So I thought, you know, even if I get what jobs are really available to me with my degree, they're going to pay me that and even offer benefits. And I was living in San Francisco, and I really didn't find anything there. And, you know, I'm glad you brought up Barbara Ehrenreich because, you know, like I said, I think she's an important historian, and Nickel and Dimed is a great book. But, you know, I think the reason why it was so important for me to tell this story was that I didn't want someone to look at a 70-year-old waitress and feel sorry for her. Because based on the research I've done, these women are happy and thriving and, you know, wouldn't have their life be any other way.
Well, and the thing that is so important to me, it's a new fact to me, one that I'm very happy to find out, and seems to me as contrary to the picture that Barbara Ehrenreich seemed to want to convey, is that people who, at least in this particular category of, quote, unskilled work, waitressing, are making good money. I mean, mm-hmm. they are successful even in an economic sense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They have made it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I found that most of these waitresses were making about $20 to $30 an hour, which is really good money, especially if you don't have a college degree. And, you know, some of them were even had health benefits, not very many, though. A lot had been union waitresses, which obviously they were getting pension and, you know, health benefits, medical benefits and stuff. But, you know, for the most part, I think, you know, with the economy the way it is and with so many people losing their jobs, a lot of people dismiss restaurant work because there's a stigma attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a chapter in the book, you know, that just really deals with where the stigma came from. And, you know, blue-collar work is definitely something that I think doesn't need to be, it needs to be celebrated and considered by people. Doesn't mean that if you don't have experience as a waitress and you decide to just go get a waitressing job, you might not make that money right off. But if it's something that you enjoy doing and that you become good at, why not make it your life, your life's work?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your contribution to our understanding.
Oh, thank you so much for your question. I appreciate it.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other questions, comments are invited for our guest, Candace Taylor, author of Counterculture, The American Coffee Shop Waitress. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Well, among the things that we learn in counterculture is that not everybody is cut out for this work. There are some folks who are good at it, and there are some folks who aren't good at it. And there is a woman who talks about that in the book. Her name escapes me at the moment, but anyway, she told you about watching waitresses new on the job make toast.
Oh, that's funny. That's Susan, yes, yes. Susan Thurman, she worked at the Rainbow Casino and Coffee Shop in Henderson, Nevada, right outside of Las Vegas. And she said that was pretty much the litmus test. She'd watch the new servers come in, and when you make toast, you know, it takes a few minutes, but there are so many things you could be doing in those 3 minutes, you know, and in her mind, in Susan's mind, she said, I'd watch them basically hover over the toaster waiting for their toast to come out. And she said the ones who did that just by and large were not good waitresses. They weren't going to last because you don't have time to stand there and wait for your toast. You know, in that time, you could have 4 new tables. You have 2 orders up. You have so many things you could be doing, cashing out somebody's check, dropping off a check, picking up an order. And you have to have that, you know, innate kind of timing and sensibility about being organized to be good at it. Otherwise, you won't be a good waitress.
Yeah. So you got to know how to make toast efficiently, but you also have to have your wits about you.
Yeah.
You have to be able to talk to people. It involves a lot of different talents, doesn't it?
It does. And I remember Laverne, a waitress in San Francisco, said the ones with the higher degrees were like made the worst waitresses. Maybe they just, I don't know, thought about it too hard or, you know, just the common sense to mm-hmm. her. You know, she said it was just funny. The ones with these big fancy degrees just couldn't wait tables.
Yeah. Are there some other tricks of the trade you could let us in on?
Well, I mean, I think knowing your customers really well in terms of, you know, having the clientele that these women have. Who was it? Virginia used to say that, you know, by the time, like, a customer would come through the door, she knew exactly what he wanted, so she'd put his order in before he sat down. And after he had been seated and his drinks had been served, his food was ready. So that really cuts your serving time in half. The fact that you can just, you know, memorize your customers' orders, knowing how to take the fewest steps possible to get the job done, because obviously it's a labor-intensive job, and that's why waitresses who generally work the counter tend to be a little more efficient than those who were doing table serving. So in some places, the waitresses who had really paid their dues were a counter waitress, and, you know, that was a esteemed part of the restaurant to work in because you could serve the most customers with the least amount of effort.
Mm.
And you had your regulars sitting right there in front of you so you could joke around with them and have fun.
Yeah, yeah. Tell us more about the counter and how important it is in the coffee shop, diner, cafe.
Well, obviously, it's the basis for, I think, where the community happens in
mm-hmm.
these places because, you know, there's no other place in the restaurant where you can sit right next to a stranger. And by that time, in a lot of these places, they're not strangers anymore because they've been sitting next to each other day in and day out for decades. I also think it's important that the counter is positioned higher than the tables. So when you know, your waitress is right there in front of you and there's more opportunity for eye-to-eye contact
mm-hmm.
because they are seated higher. And I think that also leads to more connection with their regulars. And also, I have to say, I think with, you know, like I said before, with the issue with the economy being just devastating, you know, to people who have been out of work forever and are sitting at home alone with, you know, very few options, thinking, you know, being very depressed about their likelihood of getting a job, you know, my suggestion is, you know, go to your local diner. It doesn't cost that much to have a cup of coffee and sit at the counter. You might be more likely to find a job there, you know, just by becoming a part of the counterculture and talking to people, because it's usually through people you know that, you know, that we get in to places we want to be. So, you know, it might be something to try. I think we've just gotten so, as a culture, we're just more and more privatized to the point where we've just shut ourselves off from our communities.
Yeah. Well, at the counter, you can get the news of the day and learn how people are feeling about what's happening in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can share information about your, you know, what's going on in your school, you know, where your kids are at school or
mm-hmm.
what's going on at the senior center,
mm-hmm.
All those kinds of things. Well, how does a regular relationship begin and take hold? How long does it take to become a regular?
Well, some waitresses, you know, said that, oh, they'd see the same person for several, you know, weeks or months, and then all of a sudden they'd strike up a conversation and act like they had just known each other forever. Faye, who works at Trios in Washington, D.C., says, you know, by the fourth time someone comes in, I consider them a regular, because she says, by then I know, you know, what they eat. I know whether they're diabetic. I know whether their mother is ill. She says I treat people like they're a guest in my home.
Mm.
So that's maybe because they feel that warmth from her, they're willing to share more intimate stories about their lives. And, you know, she's a rare person. She's such an amazing person.
Yeah. Some years ago, I was fortunate enough to spend a week in San Francisco
mm-hmm.
at a workshop. And I found myself going back at the end of the day before we had to, or at mid-break, because this was a workshop that began in the morning and you took a break at dinner time and you went back after dinner. But I take a break in the late afternoon, early evening, and I would go to the same place all the time. Mm-hmm. And it was a bakery where you could sit and have a cup of coffee.
Mm-hmm.
And I struck up a relationship with the waitress. And I went in there, you know, day after day, and she said, well, when did you move into the neighborhood? And I told her what I was doing. And then the next day I came back, she said, you know, while you're here, you should do this. And it was great.
Do you remember where you were? Because, you know, I'm from the Bay Area.
It was not far from, forgive me, the big base.
Fort Mason?
No, not Fort Mason. Navy.
Yeah, well, maybe you'll remember.
Yeah.
Later,
but anyway,
right.
it was a nice area, but also parts of it were a little run down. We were staying because it was expensive, we were staying in a really run down motel. That was a little scary. But, yeah, it wasn't, Oh, gosh. Well, maybe it'll come to me. It's not important anyway. But the story is what's important.
Yeah, and I think the fact that, you know, you so easily made that connection.
Yeah.
Which is great.
One of the waitresses in Counterculture, Jean Joseph, longtime waitress, and now her family, actually, they own restaurants. Is that true? Yeah. And she said to you, one of the things she said, in 15 or 20 years, you'll never find another restaurant like this.
Yeah.
What does she see on the horizon?
Well, you know, it's, who knows what the future holds, but it is kind of a sad reality. A lot of the mom and pops are closing. Small businesses are struggling. And corporate, you know, chain restaurants tend to take a lot of business. Sometimes they're offering cheaper meals and are able to, you know, for somehow get more of a customer base. But, you know, I think the idea that at Al's, where Gene works, you know, they hand grate all their potatoes and they just have a different way of doing things in terms of the quality of their food and the time and the extra money probably it takes to do that. A lot of the corporate restaurants aren't going to do because it affects the bottom line, and that's where they're operating from. A lot of these mom and pops are not necessarily operating from that place, and sadly, sometimes pay the ultimate price of, you know, not staying in business, which I think is another reason that people should frequent their local mom and pop diners and really support them, because, you know, as these waitresses age and when this generation is gone, because all the waitresses in the book are 50 and older, a lot of them are though in their 70s. Once they leave, the younger waitresses are just not quite the same. You know, they've had different experiences. They are not focused on their idea is that they are conditioned to be professional, and waitressing is hopefully for them not going to be what they do forever, because a lot of the older waitresses say the younger ones are just not good at it. They're not taking the job very seriously. There's exceptions to that rule, but for the most part, it was the only thing the waitresses complained about was the younger waitresses. So culture is changing.
So career waitresses are a dying breed?
That's, the book really addresses that, and I do think it very well could be. Yeah.
I just recalled where I was. I was within maybe about a 10 or 15-minute walk from the Presidio.
Oh, that could be any other restaurants around there.
So, but anyway, that was another lovely place to just walk around. Uh-huh. It didn't cost a nickel.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was great, the Presidio. It's now a national park. So.
Right, yeah. And it's also a film studio.
Oh,
the
really?
Presidio. Huh. George Lucas purchased it.
Yeah. Well, across the country, you covered so much territory. Is counterculture pretty much similar, whether you're in D.C., San Francisco, or Glasgow, Kentucky?
Pretty much. I also thought that, you know, there would be some geographic differences, but once you walk into the diner, it's pretty much people are people, you know. They all have their quirks, and some have more demands than others, and others are, you know, just kind of in a good mood all the time. But that sense of community and people sharing stories and gossiping about the latest news was pervasive in every area of the country that I went to. And I took my first trip about 2 weeks after 9/11, which I had considered not going because, you know, because of 9/11. But I'm glad I did, because I think even then it was more pronounced that people really needed each other and needed to come together. And I saw that firsthand in the diners.
Yeah. I also understand that you, as an African American, were a little worried about how you might be received in some places in small towns.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't turn out to be worth worrying about?
No, actually. And, you know, I mean, I went to a few places that were a little scary. I mean, Central City, Kentucky has the head of the Klan headquarters there. That was a little disconcerting, but I had no, you know, I was at Edith's Cafe, and I had just felt right at home. It was wonderful. I also went to a place in Mississippi, Greenwood, Mississippi, which Rivers Coleman was the waitress there. And that had been a card-carrying place, you know, from the 60s, from the civil rights, where there were only white people allowed to go there for many, many years, even after desegregation. But, again, I walked in, and it was very integrated, and really everybody was just so gracious to me. It was wonderful. Mm. So, no, I had no bad experiences on the road.
Mm. Well, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon. It's really been a pleasure speaking with you, and I'd recommend the book Counterculture, The American Coffee Shop Waitress. Thank you.
Thank you. Candace. Such an honor.
Candace Taylor is the author of Counterculture, The American Coffee Shop Waitress. The book is published by the Cornell University Press. You'll find her online at www.tailormadeculture.com. Her name is spelled T-A-Y-L-O-R. And that interview was from October 28th of last year. Good afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. It's 8 minutes before 2 o'clock, and standing by with settlement prices from Chicago and Kansas City, Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. In Chicago on this Monday afternoon, futures were higher. That said to be on just some position squaring. Lots of down days last week, though the market wasn't off as much maybe as you might have thought on the weekly trade. Still, a whole lot of red during the week and the end of the week last week, and they've turned that to green overnight last night and through the day today. Futures in the wheat pit before tomorrow's USDA reports, up 10 and 3 quarters for the March contract, at a high today of $4.89 and low at 76 and a quarter, with the settlement price at $4.84, 10 and 3 quarters higher for the soft red March winter wheat in Chicago. May futures, 503 the high, the low at 490 and 3 quarters, settlement price at 499, up 11, and July the harvest month, 515 and a half the high, the low at 503 and a quarter. Harvest month wheat in Chicago, 511 and a half, up 11 cents. September at 527 and a half on the settlement price, up 10 and 3 quarters with a high of 30 and a quarter and a low at 22 and a half. In Kansas City, near my March contract at 495 and a half for the hard red, up 11 cents on the afternoon. And the harvest month there finished the day. Well, I don't have a harvest month for the Kansas City hard red winter wheat at the moment. March corn futures, though, in Chicago, 356. The settlement price, 4.5 cents higher, with a high price of 362, a low at 353.5. Settled at 356, up 4.5 cents for the March corn. May futures, 373.25 the high. The low at 65.25. Settlement price at $3.67.5, up 4.5. And July contract, 383 the high, the low at 75.25. Settlement price at $3.77.5, up 4.5 cents. September futures, 360 or rather 89.25 the high, the low at $3.82.5. September corn, 384.5, up 4.25 on the day. And December futures, the harvest month in the corn pit, 396 the high, the low at $3.89, a narrow 6 cent trading range. Settlement price closer to the bottom, still good enough for a gain of 4 cents at $3.91 in the December futures for the corn. March contract, 407.75 the high, the low at $4.50. Settlement price at 403, up 4 on the afternoon. March oat futures, 231, up 4.75. The May at 240, 4.5 cents higher. Soy complex now. March beans, $9.39.75 the high, the low at 918.75, settled at 929.5, up 16. May 949.5 for the high, the low at 29.5. Settlement price at 940, up 15.75. And July 957, the high, the low at 38, settlement price at $9.48, up 15 and a quarter. August soybean, or rather August bean futures, 952 and a half, the high, the low at 39 and a quarter. Settlement price at 944, up 15 and a quarter. In September, 935 and a quarter, the high, the low at 26 and a half. Settlement price at 928 and a quarter, up 14 cents. November contract, 919 and a quarter, the high, the low at 908. Harvest month soybeans at $9.14.5 the nose. gained 11 cents on the afternoon. January contract, 928 and a quarter, the high, the low at 15 and a quarter. Settlement price at $9.23 and a half, up 10 and three quarters. March bean meal futures, 276, the high, the low at 270.270. Settlement price at 274.40, up $3.40 a ton. May contract at 268.10 on it. Settlement $3.10 the gain. March soybean oil up 95 cents, 38.47 the high, the low at 37.07. A settlement price at 37.95, up 95 for the March. And the May futures in the bean oil, 38.44. A settlement price up 96 cents on the afternoon. During the closing market report, we'll talk with Kurt Kimmel. He's at Bates Commodities in Normal, Illinois, where he serves as their senior grains analyst. And we'll do that at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time, just about 10 minutes away. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Mike Morris in McHenry at 815-344-7213. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
The livestock contracts finished on the upside today in Chicago. February live cattle, the high, 87.95, the low, 87.15. The settlement, 87.67 and a half, up 25. April, 91.20, the high, 80, I'm not quite sure there's an error there in the low price, so we'll just go on to the settlement. April live cattle finished at 90.80 today. That was up 40. June, 88.62 and a half, the high, 87.95 the low, 88.45 the settlement, up 35. August, 87.55 the high, 87.10 the low, 87.52 and a half the settlement, up 17 and a half. March feeder cattle, 99.65 the high, 98.10 the low, the settlement, 99.22 and a half, up 90. April, $100.75 the high, 99.55 the low, the settlement, $100.02 up 35. May, 101.75 the high, $100.75 the low, the settlement, 101.40 up 22 and a half. And August, 103.30 the high, 102.25 the low, the settlement, 102.82 and a half up 22 and a half. February lean hog, 67.80 today's high, 66.80 the low, the settlement, 67.57 and a half up 87 and a half. April, 69.05 the high, 67.15 the low, 68.77 and a half the settlement, up $2.05. May, 74.75 the high, 72.50 the low, 74.70 the settlement, up 2.22 and a half. June, 77.65 the high, 75.70 the low, 77.60 the settlement, up 2.17 and a half. The Dow is currently off 31 at 99.81. The NASDAQ is off 2 at 21.39. The S&P 500 is down a point at 1,065. Nearby crude up 63 at 71.82 a barrel. 2 minutes before 2 o'clock, this is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana. Online at will.illinois.edu. In the WILL severe weather coverage area, a winter weather advisory is in effect until 6 o'clock tomorrow morning in Christian, DeWitt, Logan, Macon, McLean, and Sangamon counties. In Champaign, Clark, Coles, Cumberland, Douglas, Edgar, Moultrie, Piatt, Shelby, and Vermilion counties, the advisory will be in effect at 6 o'clock tonight until 6 o'clock Wednesday morning. And in Ford, Iroquois, and Livingston counties, the advisory will be in effect from 9 o'clock tonight until 10 a.m. on Wednesday. Mike Sola's forecast for Illinois and Indiana will dispatch with all the advisories and get right to the forecast. This afternoon in western Illinois, cloudy with periods of light snow, accumulations up to 3 inches by evening. In the remainder of Illinois, cloudy with light snow arriving. In Indiana, mostly cloudy, highs ranging from 26 north to 33 south. Tonight in Illinois, periods of snow accumulating to 2 to 5 inches. In Indiana, snow moving in with accumulations of 1 to 3 by morning. Lows tonight ranging from 20 in the north to 27 in the south. Tomorrow in northern and central Illinois, periods of snow accumulating another 2 to 5 inches. Winds will increase during the afternoon and evening and cause significant blowing and drifting snow tomorrow. In northern and central Indiana, periods of snow accumulating an additional 3 to 6 inches. In southern sections, periods of light